So let's go ahead and get started. So let's make one ground rule that everybody needs to turn off or silence their cell phones. We'll start with that one. So good afternoon. My name is Sandra Heffern, and I'm a contractor with AK Health Reform. AK Health Reform came around shortly after the Affordable Care Act was passed to look at what was happening at a national level and the impact on Alaska. So the members of AK Health Reform, let's see if I can go through all of them, the Hospital and Nursing Home Association, the Primary Care Association, the Mental Health Trust, Natsu Health Foundation, Rasmussen, the Denali Commission, AARP, and the Behavioral Health Association. So all of those folks are the ones that are sponsoring today's session and the one that we had last month. So if you would join me in a round of applause in appreciation for AK Health Reform.
Yay.
All right, wonderful. Thank you. So today is our second session, or the second in a series of discussions that we're having on healthcare transformation. Today we're going to hear from our colleagues from Oregon, and they're going to talk to us about the coordinated care organizations. Last month we heard about the regional collaborative care organizations from Colorado, and this month we're going to hear from Oregon. We are working in cooperation with the Department of Health and Social Services as they're moving through the process of Medicaid reform and redesign. We just felt that there needed to be a little bit more time to really delve into some of the models that are out there. What we're hoping to do is to kind of tease out what the components are from these different models that we can then look at that might work here in Alaska. You know, I think everybody has heard, if you've seen one healthcare system, you've seen one healthcare system. So, you know, again, we really want to look at what's going to be the best model for Alaska, but we really don't have to recreate the wheel. You know, let's take advantage of what other states have done ahead of us and really learn from them. So I think that's about all I'm going to say, and I'm going to turn it over to Lori Wolf.
Thanks, everybody. Good to see many of you here again today. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Lori Wolf. I'm the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group. The 4-Acre Group is your nonprofit state association and your capacity-building organization for nonprofits across the state of Alaska. We do a number of things across the state, and one of those is to help with convenings. And so I was asked to participate in this series, so thank you for that. I get to be the referee a little bit today and also the MC, a little bit of both hats today. So a few things, just a few notes for us. So you'll already figure out it's a little bit different than last time because you're not all staring at this lovely screen right here. They blew a bulb this morning. So we are going to play a little bit of ping pong. But you have all the slides. So if you just want to draw your attention to the speakers, you're welcome to do that. And they can, and then you can just reference which slide they're on with the packet that's in front of you. So everything that's on the screen behind you here is also in your table. We are going to try a little bit of a different format than last time. We understood that you had so many questions, and we absolutely appreciated that. And we still want you to have some time at your tables to talk about what it looks like here in Alaska. So we have changed the timing a little bit to allow for questions to the presenters, but also to create actual space where you'll be talking to each other. You all have little 3x5 cards in front of you. As your questions come up, what we'd ask of you is that you write them down, and Sandra and her team members will be running around the room collecting these. So just hold them up, and we'll come get them from you, and we'll use those to ask the questions during the Q&A. So we definitely want it on the card. This is not just an exercise for you, but it allows us to keep all the questions. So we took all the questions from Colorado, and we're keeping a list of those, and so we're looking for those similarities. So we really want you to use the cards to write your questions down. You also have a yellow sticky pad of paper in every table, and we'll be using that for some small group capturing of some of the ideas that you're going to be working on after the break that ends at 3:15. So we will take a break between 3 and 3:15. You're all wonderful to devote so much of your time and energy today. We hope you'll stick with us all the way to 4:30. But if you need to leave, please, you know, make yourself comfortable for that. And the break might be that place to do that. Last thing is, Sandra wanted me to remind you, please sign in, because that's how we're be able to connect with you after the fact. And there's going to be at least two more sessions here, so one in November and one in December. We want to be able to keep track of you and be able to communicate with you, so make sure you sign in there. Okay, well, with that, we're going to jump in here. So we have three presenters today, and I'm going to read you all of their bios, and then they'll take turns doing their presentation, and then we'll move into the Q&A part. So we have Don Ross. Shake your hand. There we go. Great, thank you. So Don is a native Oregonian. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree in biology from the University of Portland. He entered healthcare after teaching marine science, and in 1991, working first with group purchasing for the Washington Hospital Association, and then a managed care network development and operations for health plans in Washington and Oregon for 13 years. Don then joined the state Medicaid agency policy and delivery systems leadership in 2009. Don lives in Portland with his three children, one of who are in college and middle school, and he enjoys exploring the outdoors. He told me he likes this weather that we're having. I told him I kind of like Oregon weather a little bit better, but, you know, that's okay. So then we have Aaron, sitting next to Don there. So Aaron Taylor is the executive director of the CCO Partnership and Development at CARE Oregon. Aaron has had the good fortune of having a front row seat in Oregon's recent health transformation efforts. She served as the lead health policy staff person in the Oregon legislature in 2007 and 2009, which both heralded landmark health transformation legislation. Erin now leads CARE Oregon's work in the collaborative development of four coordinated care organizations across Oregon. Prior to her arrival in Oregon to study law at the University of Oregon, Erin studied public health at Tulane University School of Public Health, and she is a proud Florida Gator. Sure, you'll find at least one other fan in this room. Martin Taylor is the Director of Public Policy and Community Relations at CARE Oregon. In his role, he has worked with the Governor's Office and Oregon State Legislature on health reform, including the development of legislation that created the CCOs in 2011. He led the creation and development of CARE Oregon Member Advisory Council, giving voice to the 270,000 individuals and families receiving services associated with the organization. In addition to public policy and community relations, he oversees the communications department, the digital marketing department, and the distribution of CARE Oregon's Community Benefits Fund, which is more than $1 million annually in charitable donations. So please help me give them a great Alaska welcome to our speakers. John, you're going to go first.
Okay, yeah. Good afternoon. Thanks for having us here. I hope it's useful, and look forward to sharing a little bit of the state Medicaid agency's perspective with you. So a little bit of background on Oregon's situation. This was $3.9 million in 2012, which is when we launched the actual operational implementation of our transformation. The policy and legislative work began actually before that. Urban, rural, and frontier communities, tourism, fishing, timber, technology, and agriculture. You're familiar with the big companies in Oregon, include Intel, Nike, and Adidas. The current Medicaid enrollment is pretty close to 1.2 million. We did have some delay of some of the redeterminations. We got some extensions on that, and we think that caseload will come down a little bit as well. Our unemployment rate is pretty low right now, relatively speaking, and so the caseload for the moment seems to not be growing like crazy. Most of those individuals are in Medicaid managed care plans, and most of those that are not in a Medicaid managed care plan have an exemption from managed care enrollment due to having other insurance as primary, or because they are American Indian or Alaska Natives who can opt into managed care enrollment but do not have to. We did the expansion in 2014 of the Medicaid population to ACA adults, and it actually took us from about 675,000 statewide on Medicaid to about 1 million, and then it's grown a tiny bit since then as well. So we have a single state Medicaid agency that administers both Title 19 and Title 21. We have multiple 1115 waivers. The first was our managed care waiver back in 1994, and we've included the links in case it's useful to your research and your policy considerations to go take a look at our waiver and state plans. The current waiver that we're on was went into effect in July of 2012, and we're getting ready to renew that work has already begun, and you can view that as well. So we had more than 50% of the babies born in Oregon, those deliveries paid for by Medicaid. So to give you an idea of what the population looks like, I think that's pretty telling that most newborns are born into poverty in Oregon. 16% of all Oregonians in Medicaid, 85% of Oregon providers participate in Medicaid. That means they're enrolled and they can bill Medicaid. Some of those providers see a lot more Medicaid than others. And in the neighborhood of 11% of the total state budget. Some of these figures are from 2 or 3 years ago, and some are more current. It has been the fastest growing portion of the state's budget. So why transform? I was talking with some folks at the Hospital Association this morning, and I didn't know really how else to say it except that you're ready for really profound transformation when you've tried everything else and nothing works. And so I think I said you have to be at a certain stage of desperation to consider certain options that wouldn't really be palatable prior to then. And in Oregon, we recognized that the costs on the Medicaid system weren't sustainable, and that we weren't getting the health outcomes for what we were spending. So there was a very robust stakeholder engagement that included a roadshow from the health authority and the governor's office across the state to various communities, and then a large stakeholder group that the governor's office invited various parts of the statewide community to participate in, which met in our capital in Salem weekly for months and months to collect input that became the sort of blueprint for our changes. And that last bullet there is also known as the triple aim. That came from Dr. Berwick at CMS, maybe originally coined that, but better health, better care, and lower costs. Okay. I'll just get a little closer to the microphone. So this graphic just kind of shows you how we had managed physical health contracts. We had managed mental health contracts. We had managed dental health contracts. We had people in fee-for-service, people in managed care, and all the pieces of the puzzle. It was kind of a fragmented system. And we'd also heard for years from providers and from managed care entities that part of the barrier to integrating all aspects of care around a sort of a household or a patient-centered plan is that the funding streams are all separate, and that to really integrate the care, it might be a good idea to integrate the funding streams too. You've probably all seen graphics like this before. That indicate how much of a person's actual wellness really comes from the medical care they get, and the rest of it is socioeconomic and behaviors. So probably not new information there, but it's part of the context in which we worked on our changes. So the components of the transformation, by far the biggest one, is the change in the contracting and the incentives and the delivery system. And those we call coordinated care organizations. And my colleagues here are going to talk some more about what it's like to be one of those. Community level accountability for the triple aim. new models of integrated care that are patient-centered, team-focused. A lot of services are delivered now by non-licensed staff, and licensed staff working at the top of their license. Integrated across physical, behavioral, and oral health. Governance by a partnership of providers of care, community members, stakeholders, and those who have some risk, financial risk. A global budget that grows at a sustainable fixed rate. I put an asterisk on the fixed rate because we do have CMS actuaries involved in our rate setting now in Oregon, and that's a recent development. It started in 2014. Use of non-traditional healthcare workers, which we've actually also, we call traditional health workers because in many ways they're more traditional than what we think of as convention, but these include peer wellness specialists, health navigators, community health workers, doulas, and those types of providers. And so the idea behind this graphic was to get all those pieces of the puzzle sort of fit together in a way that results in better outcomes and better controls on rising costs. The contracting process involved a request for application, which we posted, and then we had letters of intent come from a large number of entities that were interested in being part of the new delivery system, an application review and certification process that involved leadership at the Oregon Health Authority and within the Medicaid agency, and then setting up some work streams for the implementation across agencies that included, at the time, Addictions and Mental Health Division and Public Health and the Medicaid agency. Improved communication models with contractors and stakeholders. And the final passage of enabling legislation occurred in the spring of 2012, and the marching orders to make it go live 4 months later in August. So the implementation work was just during that four-month period between May and August of 2012. And we established a transformation center also, which is a part of the health authority that facilitates the collaborative learning and sharing of innovation between different partners in the new delivery system. And also awarded some grants to fund some of that innovation. Local governance is a big piece of Oregon's transformed system and something that we're kind of proud of because in thinking about the triple aim, we were thinking ideally there would be a quadruple aim, right? As long as you're overhauling the system of care, you might as well make it something where the satisfaction of the consumers who use it is high too, which at least traditionally has not always been the case with users of Medicaid services because they're using a system that frequently wasn't really built to serve them. It was built to serve privately insured people. So our statutory framework says that that the entities or organizations should share in the financial risk, that at least there should be two healthcare providers in active practice involved on boards, at least two community members, and one member of the Community Advisory Council. So there's consumer involvement and financial stakeholder involvement. Community Advisory Councils, which every CCO has, needs to be made up mostly of consumers, should include representatives from county and local government, and the duties include development or assistance with development of a community health improvement plan and reporting on the progress of that. So before 2012, we did have a lot of managed Medicaid in Oregon. We had 15 fully capitated health plans. We had 10 contractors that delivered mental health care and 8 that delivered dental health care. We had some PCO contracts, and we also delivered non-emergent medical transportation through 8 statewide transportation brokerages. This was carved out of the managed care contracts and delivered by the state, even for those people who are enrolled in managed care. and most of those brokerages were local transit authorities. And then we had disease case management for the fee-for-service populations that were not enrolled in a managed care plan. After the transformation in 2012, we ended up with 16 CCOs, 15 run by 15 different organizations. Right away on August, well, in the summer, the first ones went live in August, and then there were some more that went live in September and October and November. But the initial contracts had physical and behavioral health all put together into the global budget. And then over the subsequent time between the fall of 2012 and now, we have integrated dental statewide, non-emergent medical transportation, and we're looking at some of our other services in the waiver to integrate in, such as targeted case management and mental health residential. So we still have that integration work to do to put into the managed care contracts. We also, the enabling legislation allowed for a phasing out of some of the old types of managed care contracts, so that if there were populations in any part of the state that couldn't, for whatever reason, move to a CCO, that they wouldn't end up in fee-for-service and with poor access. So some of those other contracting models remained, and statutorily they can be around until July 2017. We also we did a Section 2703 health home state plan amendment. So for a couple of years we had federal funding to provide additional per patient per month reimbursement to certified patient-centered primary care homes, which is Oregon's version of the PCMH, or patient-centered medical home. More than 400 clinics across Oregon are certified at three different tiers, many at tier three, and there is encouragement in the CCO contracts to empanel as many members as possible with a certified PCPCH as the medical home. We also have an alternative payment methodology model in place for safety net clinics that's available to FQHCs and RHCs and tribal 638 clinics in Oregon. Right now, about 100,000 lives have their medical home at an FQHC that is receiving a PMPM per month from the state instead of the per-visit PPS rate. And what this has done is allow the clinics to get their physicians sort of off the treadmill, where the only way to maintain or increase revenue is to bill more office visits, and disconnecting their payment from the billable PPS office visit has enabled them to build care teams that take advantage of non-licensed staff and what would otherwise be non-billable visits to engage patients in innovative ways. We're just about ready any day here to get a completed report from an actuarial consultant about what that's done to the total cost of care for those individuals. But we've already seen data that it reduces the ED visits and the inpatient hospital stays. So the CCO contracts are built with some incentive measures. So they have some performance. There are performance expectations on the CCOs, and there's money tied to those. And that includes the percentage of individuals whose medical home is a certified patient-centered home, among other things. These aren't all the metrics, but these are the kinds of things you would expect to see up there. Adolescent well care, developmental screenings in the first 36 months of life, depression screenings, and a follow-up expert type model. Child and immunization, mental and physical and dental health assessments within 60 days for kids in child welfare. CCOs are making funded, again, this is not an exhaustive list of examples, they're doing some really cool things. CCOs making funding available to primary care practices specifically to increase their mental health integration. CCO working on information sharing between their primary care offices, juvenile justice, and other social services. And the CCOs also meet regularly in learning collaboratives to share their ideas with one another so that they can learn from each other about what's working and what isn't. So 3 years or so into this, we know some things that we didn't know when we started out that I think are of interest to people sitting in your chairs who are considering major changes to your system. The transformation is really hard, and it takes time. Okay, you probably already knew that, but it's your will and your stakeholder support around it really has to be big, or else it's I think probably really difficult to see it through. It costs some money to transform because your new system isn't going to look like your old system, and that means investments have to be made. And when you're struggling with fiscal issues, it's really hard to think about making those investments. Maintaining institutional knowledge is critical. Healthcare transformation includes cultural transformation. Organizations have cultures, and when you make major changes to the organizations involved or you make major changes to them internally, that has cultural impacts. Flexibility spawns a variety of different CCO organization models. So while there is a very specific requirements that CCOs had to meet in order to be certified and enter into a contract with the state to be a CCO, there's also flexibility built into that contract that allows for innovation. And one of those, one area of flexibility was really around how they're structured and how those partnerships were built in each community varies quite a bit across the state. Also, writing an integrated contract and merging those funding streams that I talked about at the top of the presentation doesn't necessarily make you an integrated system yet. I think we were pretty clear after the first year that we had CCOs up and running how much actual transformation had taken place that was impactful to people receiving care. That started to come a little bit later. Because we only had 4 months to get them going, it was really about just getting the contracts in place and assigning the eligible portions of the population to their new payers. And then the real innovation started to occur. Timing's really important. The Affordable Care Act, in our case, major portions of it didn't take effect until after we had done our planning and our stakeholder engagement and our procurement. So we got to do that during 2011 and 2012 and then have things up and running for a year before 2014 came and we took our Medicaid population from just under 700,000 to over a million. CMS was a really critical partner in our transformation, not only because of the investment they made in it, but also their policy folks and our leadership at the health authority had hours and hours and hours together every week talking about what our ideas were and where in the federal regulatory framework they could make those fit. And also over-communicating, obviously, we would recommend doing that. We tried to do that. We knew immediately whenever we had failed to communicate well enough. That was really always really apparent. you can't overdo that, basically, is the bottom line. And be flexible. You know what? When you're making lots of changes simultaneously, you don't know what the interaction between the new initiatives is going to be. And right? So you build them to have a particular effect. But it's like an ecosystem. They all influence one another. And so being flexible and sort of light on your feet, being willing to try things, but also monitor their effectiveness and then make changes to them early on and repeatedly, not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't mean your commitment level is low. And then my contact information is in there in case you have questions or need information that doesn't occur to you until after today's talks are over.
All right. So, hey, good news. No PowerPoint. Does mean you're looking this way. And if you have trouble seeing me, I don't mind standing up, although I think sitting might work. So first off, let's thank our hosts from Alaska for bringing us up here. Thank you very much to the PCA and to the Hospital Association, all of you in the room, for joining us. You make us feel very smart and important when you bring us up, like that's a big deal. I will confess, a lot of what we learned in two visits to South Central, and so to some extent, I feel like, well, we came up here in the late, you know, just before like 2007, 2008, 2009, learned a bunch from South Central, went back to Oregon, did a bunch of stuff, and now we're back to tell you about it. So I guess we only get to feel smart because we came here, and that was the smart thing. We came here, and then we came back. I also want to thank Don. You know, we've had a huge transition in Oregon's staff at the Oregon Health Authority. Some of that came with the change of governors. We also had a change of executive directors. We've lost a lot of really talented people to other states. Our Medicaid director, Judy Moore Peterson, now runs the Medicaid system in Hawaii. So don't steal Don, all right? We have some folks left that are really talented, and Don's among those, so thank you for being here. Let me just briefly what CARE Oregon is. It might help. You're not as familiar with CARE Oregon as folks in Oregon are. We're a quarter of the Medicaid system. We have four CCOs. And our story the last few years is pretty straightforward. We were a statewide Medicaid plan. We advocated for dramatic change and transformation in the Medicaid system. We were successful in helping a very inspired group of legislators and governor and other stakeholders transform our healthcare system, and then we got turned completely inside out almost overnight. The biggest of those changes is we couldn't be a statewide plan anymore. We had to have local boards, so we essentially did a Ma Bell type experience. We became four or part of four CCOs. All of them have different boards. All of them have different relationships, two of which we own, one of which we're a partial stakeholder of, one of which we're just a TPA for. So anything we try to say categorically is contradicted someplace else in our business model. We also brought on an oral health plan, and we have a dual-eligible Medicaid plan. So Medicare plan, sorry. And so what essentially CARE Oregon is, we provide services for a quarter of the Medicaid population, or about 270,000 people, which is a lot, but we do it in a way that's too complicated to give you straight answers. And that's really frustrating sometimes to our audiences and to legislators. I should say that the other thing about CARE Oregon is we're a little bit of the tip of the tip of the spear. CARE Oregon's health care reform actually took place a year before the ACA passed. A good deal of the ACA was lifted from Oregon's law. And we have been sort of an early adopter of most of the big transformation ideas that are located both in the ACA, but frankly, we do a lot of stuff that's not at all part of federal health care reform. And so CARE Oregon is that plan in Oregon that has the largest footprint in Medicaid and the most expectations on it. We're sort of a leading plan in Oregon, and Oregon is a leading actor in the national reform movement. So that makes us a little bit of the tip of the tip of the spear. And so you're going to hear from Aaron a little bit from now. Aaron and I are married, and we have a son, Wyatt, who's sleeping in the room next door. So I'm going to brag on Aaron for just a second, but she wrote the contracts for four CCOs. She framed their board. She's guided them in their creation story. So she's basically started four businesses in the last 3 years that are all substantial in their community. She's going to be a better person to give you all of that source information. But what an amazing and interesting state to be in, where you're there at a time when folks get thrown forward, frankly, out of the staff of an organization and say, why don't you go create some companies? Do it with all the highest expectations that anyone in the country has come up with. And just to make that more complicated, your Medicaid plan. So these are the things you don't control. The state assigns you all your members, so you don't control your customer. They tell you what the benefit package is, so you actually don't control your product. Oh, and they control your price. They tell you how much you get paid for it. So just start businesses where you don't control the product, the customer, or the price, but have a huge regulatory oversight, and you've got to create them in about a year, and they've got to be made up of all of the community stakeholders, most of whom have spent generations fighting with each other. Go do that. So, yeah. Aaron's impressive. So why is this important? Well, so let's start with this. Our legislature didn't do this just to torture us or make us seem interesting to folks in other states. We really started with a very basic expectation that the public in Oregon had for us, which is that the percentage of the state budget that was going up for health care was going up faster than the percentage of the state budget for anything else by a lot, because health care inflation is simply greater than other inflation. So our public did not want more and more money going to health care. They wanted money going to schools or parks or other things. If you think about it, in a large extent, Medicaid is paying for things that aren't working. It's paying into a system for poverty and sickness. And people would rather, taxpayers would rather put something into education or parks, which feels like they're investing in some future. It's a more optimistic set of goals. I understand that. There was a lot of pressure to control that cost. And there was a national movement around healthcare reform at the time that Oregon started doing this. And then we got the one big bonus, the blessing, which was a recession, which crashed our budget. So all of a sudden, on top of those things that were, we want money to go to schools and other things that reflect our optimism and an expectation that we do healthcare reform, there was a crisis, and the crisis drove us into this model. But we were ready for it, and we were ready for it partially because of the visits to South Central, but frankly, because we had leadership, both political and legislative leadership, and stakeholder industry leadership that said, what are the best practices around the world? What are the things that are going on that we can take and lift? What's the IHI? What's the Triple Aim? What's Don Berwick? We had a very curious group of folks that started bringing all of these sort of thought leaders from around the country into the Oregon dialogue. So I don't think that it was the fact that we went first wasn't a product of anything particularly special about Oregon. We captured a moment perfectly. We had the right leaders, the right thinking, and the right crisis. Having said that, the reason it was important is that healthcare budgets everywhere, including Alaska, including any place in the United States, are not sustainable at that rate of inflation. Broadly speaking, the public is going to have the same reaction everywhere, which is we cannot crush other programs that we care about on the backs of healthcare expenditures. And the second is that the public is now by far the largest purchaser of healthcare. So in Oregon, when we started this reform in 2010, the state purchased 40% of the healthcare. If you count all the public employees, all of Medicaid, all the high-risk populations, 40% of the healthcare dollars were state dollars. So when you've got such a large percentage of your budget being eaten up and such a large commitment in terms of the total economy of healthcare in one purchaser's hands, it became sort of fundamental not just to the progressive or liberals in our state. It became fundamental to our conservative Republican lawmakers. We are not going to spend that much money this badly any longer. We were not purchasing healthcare in a smart way. We were dividing our purchasing up between many different plans. We were breaking up physical and oral and mental health. We had no measures. We had no transparency for the plans to tell us how they were spending that money and whether that money was buying the outcomes they wanted. They basically were being given large contracts from the state, and then the managed care systems were expected to deliver what was essentially a compliance model, which is you now provide health care for that group of folks. We would never have created something loose for a school system. If it was just schools, here's a bunch of money, you go educate the kids. No, we want to know what the grades look like. We want to know the kids are attending class. We want to know what the outcomes for schools were. But we weren't putting those same standards on our Medicaid system. So the state started what we call the smart purchasing strategy. We essentially made a commitment to spend the dollars we were getting for health care in a smart and wise way. That meant doing a variety of things, and this variety of things are really reflected by this sheet. I want to direct your attention to this really colorful handout. This comes off the Oregon Health Authority's website. I don't think Don actually wrote this one, but he could have. It's a little bit of the playbook for CCOs. Now, I will confess, this is a document that's intended to tell commercial insurers how they can begin to adapt the CCO model to commercial insurance. So there are a few things in here that I'm going to call out that are more Medicaid-specific that aren't on here, and a few things that are on here that may not be exactly applicable to Medicaid, but I love this document because it does a great job of explaining the six components of CCOs. And the most important is that these are the things it takes to leverage public money to meet the Triple Aim objectives, to bring down the cost of healthcare. So it starts with this. The first most important component is a global budget. Global budget essentially is public policymakers saying, in healthcare, we've got this much money for healthcare. Whatever that dollar amount is, Alaska is going to be different than Oregon, and saying, within the amount of money we've got to spend on healthcare, you as the healthcare stakeholders have to figure out how to manage to that budget. So we're not paying you all separately for separate things. We're essentially putting you in a relationship with one another where you've got to manage a global budget. And from that global budget, you create a shared responsibility for the health of a community. And that shared responsibility essentially says your hospital, your primary care system, your oral health system, your mental health system, to some extent community social service agencies are all in it together. You've got this much money to manage. If you do it well and people are healthier than the state expects, there'll be a margin, and that upside risk you'll split up. If you can't do it, then you're essentially going to create some downside risk, and you're all going to be in the same predicament together. It won't be the hospitals against primary care, mental health against physical health. You go up or you go down together as a group, and you bring the community into the process. What that does is it creates these four things. It creates an enormous amount of incentive to do the best practices. So best practice is no longer something that the state has to try to mandate or regulate. It's no longer a hypothetical question. You're at a table with one another, and you're going to figure out what your best practices are, because that's what it takes to make this global budget create upside risk. You're going to measure. You're going to measure one another, because you're going to want to know who in your group is living up to their expectations and who isn't. But you also have the state involved in that measurement process, so the state can essentially create performance incentives. So in Oregon, when we meet certain metrics, we get millions of dollars of additional money back from the state. So those performance measures essentially say we're going to invest in a quality healthcare system. It's not enough simply to have a healthcare system. We need to know that it's performing well. You create pay incentives for good outcomes, and all of this is based on a higher level of transparency than you had in the past. All of that data has to be publicly available in order to pay for the good measures, to pay for the good outcomes. But that transparency alone creates obligations and expectations. So if you've got weak partners in your community, you know who they are, and there's an opportunity to address that. So if you can imagine for a moment, this room right here was a group of folks who are going to go through the Oregon 2011 experience of speed dating. This is pretty much what happened to us. I'm not even exaggerating. When they passed the laws around CCOs, they put a room full of folks, and then I know you're not all from Anchorage, but this would be our equivalent, you know, be Portland. There'd be about this many people in the room, about 60 folks in the room. They would be from all different sectors, and they basically stuck us in there and said, all right, you need to figure out how to create, through this global budget, shared responsibility for risk, a governance structure, hold each other to these best performances, measure each other, do it in a transparent way, and then we're going to give you the contract. And if you can't do it, some other room that looks like this is going to, and they're going to get the contract and you're out. That was our experience. And that remarkable experience has produced some remarkable results, some of which Don has explained to you. But I would also say that one of those remarkable results is that you're beginning to see this model moving into the commercial market. And I'm really glad Moda's here today. I want to call out Robin Richardson, Sean Jessup, not just because they're Oregonians and friends and peers. But Moda, as a health plan, has one of the CCOs that's most like you. It's very rural. It's also for our public employees who are teachers, created several CCO-like products for them to choose. My understanding is they don't have the greatest uptake yet. But the point isn't to get everyone to buy the product day one. The point is that can you build the product for the commercial market and have innovative companies like Moda be able to move that product so that the kinds of reforms that make sense, that are smart, don't just make sense in Medicaid, they make sense in the commercial market as well. That includes Providence and Kaiser, Pacific Source and Moda as those early adopters. And we have a new entry in our market, Centene. I don't know much about them, but Centene has arrived in Oregon. And I think that you're going to hear a story in 5 or 10 years where the CCOs aren't associated with just Medicaid, but the CCO model, CCM, is the CCO, their coordinated care model, is in fact the model of care that best reflects the marketplace in Oregon, both commercial and Medicaid. Just a couple of last points. There's a bunch of stuff that I'm not covering in our conversation today. I don't know if Aaron's going to cover it, but because you're sort of at step one, we're not spending as much time talking about what's coming next. I would say that we do see a lot of our work connecting to what we call the social determinants of health. We're beginning to get involved in housing and food and other things. That's an interesting conversation, but probably not a step one conversation. CCOs 3.0 will probably also have a conversation around long-term care and other things that legislators may want to piggyback onto the early learning. They might want to piggyback onto the CCO model. So there's a future for CCOs that make us even more complicated. And I think that as that happens, you're going to see a distinction between CCOs, the Medicaid product, and CCO model, which is really for the commercial market. I'm not sure that, Aaron and I probably don't need to have our health plan start getting into our food security. We're probably okay having Kaiser just take care of our health. But for our Medicaid members, it may make sense to have deliberate connections between the Medicaid plans and social services. I think that's a wrap. I would point out just one last thing, that on Don's slide, he had a key component slide. Not every CCO, Medicaid CCO plan is meeting all those key components. We've been given a pass for a while. I think at some point we're all going to have to do that model a little bit better. And he also said that the Medicaid contracting models have gone from 35 to now 16 plans, but my guess is someday you'll have fewer than 16 CCOs as well, just a way of saying that OHA is presenting you a current state, but the future state, there's still a lot of change. We still have a long ways to go. That's it.
So I want to make a quick observation. I had the advantage of going last, which means I can skip through some of my slides. So so I'll save you some of my airtime. But the observation is just how aligned some of my slides and even some of my graphics are to what Don said, and I think that's a testament to the robust public process and stakeholder involvement we had as a community. We've gotten really well versed at talking about this in the same way. I think we clearly identified which values and initiatives we think are most important as a state as we're managing our Oregon Health Plan program, and so we're using similar words and ideas to talk about it, which means we've got great alignment between those operationalizing the work on the ground from the CCO perspective and from the state, which
is
great.
Good enough partners to steal from each other.
Yes, which is great. We advocate stealing this kind of stuff. So Martin talked a little bit about CARE Oregon, so I'll gloss over this slide. Only touch on a couple of things at the bottom, and that is we're still slightly tilted more towards female members than male, and that's because pregnant women have a little higher eligibility, but now with ACA expansion, we're much closer, 50-50, than we were prior to the ACA expansion. 26% of our members do not speak English as their first language. We've got about, I think, 12 major languages that we translate our materials into, but there are many more than that, so we're relatively diverse, especially compared to the rest of Oregon. And then 46% self-identify as non-Caucasian, which, again, if you've been to Oregon, this is a disproportionate share of a diverse population relative to Oregon as a whole. Just a quick picture of Oregon. This is a little bit old, but I think the numbers still stand, and that's in 2010, our poverty rate was about 12.2%. You can see the darker the color, the higher the poverty rate. So relative to our neighbors, Oregon is by far the most poor of our neighbors in the West. And so we had a kind of social imperative to get services for low-income people right in the state of Oregon. You got a little bit of legislative history. Martin talked about House Bill 2009, which was the first major landmark piece of legislation, that some pieces of it were lifted and put into the ACA or the Patient Protection and Accountable Care Act in 2010. So we were a little bit further down the road and had taken some of the pieces of the Accountable Care Act into account when we were thinking about our transformation, and then 2011 and 12 were the CCO laws that were passed. Talked about the triple aim already, and you recognize that graphic as well. So our fragmented system and then state budget woes. So a little bit more about the state budget shortfall. We had taken a rate cut in 2011 at 11%. The state literally just took 11% off the top and said, live within this. And so we had a scramble to figure out how we were going to do that. And then in 2012, we were facing another 19% shortfall. And there was panic where we thought, you know, 11% we sort of swallowed hard and made it work, you know, had to cut some of our provider rates, had to cut staff, had a hiring freeze at the state, but another 30% cut was totally unsustainable, and we didn't really know what we were going to do to do that. And then also relative to many of our other similarly situated state, Oregon is a relatively efficient market. We don't have some of the fat that states like Florida or New York or parts of Texas that you sometimes hear about see, so we didn't have very many low-hanging fruits. So we really had to think about creative disruption and innovation as a strategy. So traditionally, you know, cut the what you pay for services as an option, the number of people, so you cut eligibility, cut benefits. Those are the way that people usually talk about filling budget holes. But through the leadership of our legislators, our governor's office, and the other stakeholders at the table, we said, we don't want to do it. We've been through that. We've cut rates, and then you have issues with access because you have providers that aren't willing to contract with you and provide services. If you cut the number of people on the plan, then you just shift costs elsewhere, and you have more uninsured people, and then you pay for it in other ways. If you cut benefits, similar thing happens. We've moved the line, as we talk about on our prioritized list, and then again we have a cost shift because then you're just not covering necessary services. So we knew from experience in Oregon that either any of these three really weren't going to get at the fundamental issue and weren't going to solve our budget crisis for the long term. So the vision through our stakeholder model, which you've heard a little bit about, but this kind of couches it a little bit differently. Four primary components are integration and coordination of benefits and services, so getting away from that fragmentation. Local accountability, you've heard from these other my other co-presenters, at local boards, our community advisory councils, really having the key stakeholders in each community accountable for the performance of the CCO. Standards for safe and effective care. This is represented through our CCO metrics, which I'll talk about in a little bit, but Martin touched on that as well. And then a global budget index to a sustainable growth rate. And the theory was or is that will, those four components will result in a redesigned delivery system and then ultimately the triple aim. We're kind of in step two here. So we had CCOs come together. They are trying to figure out that redesigned component. And part of the issue was that we couldn't just say, okay, nobody in Medicaid access any services for about 6 or 8 months. We're going to figure this out and then you can come back, right? We had to kind of change the tire while we were going 75 miles an hour. And so we had to implement the governance structure, contract out for some of the services, you know, figure out how we were going to have all of our bases covered. And I liken it to kind of putting the scaffolding up when you're going to renovate your home. We've got all the scaffolding up. We know what it's going to look like, but we're in that process now of figuring out, you know, what really needs to happen now that we've learned about what a CCO, what the potential is there. And then the whole country is watching. So this is also a little bit of an old slide, but it was a high-pressure situation. This is the definition of a CCO is defined by the state. I'm going to skip through some of these. We also looked at some of the components of the commons, which Eleanor Ostrom is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. She just passed away a couple of years ago, but she wrote about parts of the world that organize around managing common resources, so things like fisheries and water and forest land and that kind of thing. And for us, we think about healthcare system as a commons as well. It's a finite resource. Everybody needs it at some point or another. Rules are made locally and should be adapted to the context. So these are some of the principles that we use when we're thinking about, as we continue to think about what a CCO ought to be and how it ought to operate from a governance perspective. It demands a more horizontal approach than I think traditional healthcare has operated under. So we're really democratizing how healthcare itself is delivered and how resources are allocated. It's much more of a network model than a direct, vertically integrated kind of model that depends mostly on contracts. So we're interdependent. We're starting to really be explicit about the interdependencies that are more complex than a sort of A and B contracting model. It requires a multitude of stakeholders. We've gotten really adept at working with a variety of different kinds of stakeholders and being much more culturally competent about how we engage folks. We can't talk about, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I can't use lawyer speak in many of the audiences that I'm working with. And so we've gotten much more adept at, you know, using real language to talk about how people access and experience their healthcare system. And it's got to be a community solution. As Martin said, we're recognizing that to really be effective and really manage within the global budget, we've got to get more upstream. So that pie that Don showed where 10% of what actually impacts a person's health takes place in a clinical setting or in the medical setting. So we're getting into much more of that lifestyle and behavior piece of the pie where we're thinking about food security, partnering with K-12 education for prevention services and that kind of thing. So there's the pie. So this is another snapshot of that timeline that Don touched on, and I'll just say quickly that that I think the time element was both a blessing and a curse. We had the looming budget crisis that forced everyone to the table. The legislature signed House Bill 3650, which said, go forth and tell us what you think a CCO ought to be. And there was a broad stakeholder process for designing the components of the CCO model. the legislature in 2012 then passed the legislation that sort of deemed that the work of that process into law in March. April 1, our letters of intent were due, and by July, we had to have all of our CCO application materials in for the certification process. We had a really attenuated condensed timeline for between the law actually passing and going live on September 1, and we had to have our transformation plans due to the state that told them what was going to be different in each of our communities by the fact of having a CCO in that community by January. So we had to have some really deep thinking on a very, very short timeline. The key components that we wrestled with in that very short timeline were geographic and demographic scope. That was no small thing. As Martin said, Care Oregon was at one large managed care organization, and we knew we had to turn ourselves inside out with local boards to meet that local accountability requirement. And so figuring out what the geographic scope of each of our CCOs was a significant process. And it was based primarily on who were our partners on the ground, where were we prior to the CCO experiment, who wanted us to be there. There were some service areas that we exited because we didn't have deep partnerships with the provider community and other stakeholders on the ground. And then there were others that said, please come be our CCO partner in that community. And we thought that invitation was a really important component. We had to have all the business and operations in place, also no small task to make sure we had all the information systems in place to be able to do claims processing, information measurement, take files from the state so that we knew which members were enrolled with each of our CCOs, that kind of thing, and staff training to be able to speak about this new world intelligently was no small task either. Building the boards of directors and the community advisory councils, having a robust recruitment process so that people knew what they were signing up for to serve on our boards or our CACs, engaging both our internal clinical staff and our external clinicians in developing our model of care, our integration plan and platform, figuring out which partnerships we needed with other social service agencies, long-term care, a number of others. And then what our plan was for prevention and keeping people healthy so that we could live within that global budget and demonstrate on healthy outcomes. And then finally, last but certainly not least, one that takes still a significant amount of airtime is the financing, figuring out where risk was going to be borne and shared and how those dollar flows were going to be transmitted transparently so that people knew what the financial performance was and what the drivers of that performance would be, or non-performance as the case may be, figuring out alternative payment methodologies so that we were able to share risk and able to pay for performance or pay for better outcomes. So those are the key components. And the questions that we continue to ask ourselves are these. I think these are really important questions. Can we do more with less? Can we do more of what works and measure it so that we know what's actually working? And I think the hardest one of all is, can we let go of what doesn't work? Because often that means telling your friends, neighbors, colleagues, we don't really need your work, or what you're doing isn't adding as much value as some other thing that we might invest in. And that is a really difficult thing to wrestle with. Finally, how do we together foster communities that support best possible lives for everyone in Oregon? And that together word is really where we spend a lot of our time focused. This is a map of all of the CCOs, the ones that are circled there in the northwest. There are three kind of in the northwest corner, or three that we're working closely with or own or support. And then down in southern Oregon and Jackson County is the fourth CCO that we work with. And the orange piece over there on the right is the CCO that MODA is a partner in. And then, so this is just a kind of a value proposition, but Martin really touched on this, just that so much of our state budget goes towards Medicaid, and that many now, that especially with ACA expansion, so much of the payer, CCOs are such a large portion of the payer mix for most providers, or many providers now, that they're sort of don't have any choice but to think about how to engage with their local CCOs. The metrics, too, is real money. So the state has a metrics and scoring committee that sets how CCOs will be measured. There are 36 total measures, but 17 of those are what we call incentive metrics, which means they have dollars attached to them. The state now withholds 4% of the value of the CCO global budget, and we have the chance to earn that 4% back based on our metrics performance. So 4% withheld, if we meet 12 of 17 incentive measures and 60% of our members are enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home, and we meet the benchmark or improvement target for our electronic health record adoption measure, then we can earn that 4% back, and it's big dollars. If the CMS wanted to make sure we didn't leave any of those dollars on the table, so there's a challenge pool. So if any of the CCOs don't make their quality pool or have any portion of it left behind, then the rest of us can compete for whatever dollars are left on the table with this challenge pool. And it's based on our performance with alcohol and drug screening, diabetes A1C, poor control, depression screening, and patient-centered primary care home enrollment. So it creates some, I think, healthy competition between our CCOs. And I will tell you, people have asked, do the metrics work? There's maybe some difference of opinion about whether they measure the right thing, but they have absolutely driven behavior because it's not just chump change, and if we lose it, then oh well. It's really real dollars, and we've invested heavily in engaging our provider community on performing to these measures so that we don't leave those on the table. So this is a list. I'm not going to read them out loud. I've also included what changes are made. Part of the challenge is that they haven't all stayed the same, or some of them. You can see on number three, the ESPERT screening was 18 and up, and they added adolescents. So that measures that sometimes the population that applies is expanded. With dental integration, dental components have come in as well. So it's a robust list, to say the least. This gives you an idea of the dollars. So for our four CCOs, you've got $4.2 million, $34.5 million, $4.7, $2.9, and these are, you can see the total enrollment there on the side. So 25,000, between 25 and 30,000 members, and then 225,000 total for HealthShare of Oregon. So this is why it's driving behavior, because this is very big dollars in each of these communities, and the state requires that each CCO reinvest these dollars within their provider community to promote quality behavior going forward. So that it's not money that CCOs just keep or can pay bonuses to their executives or anything like that. We are by law required to reinvest these dollars into the provider community to increase capacity and quality performance. So I'll go through, this is a, you can look at this on your slide, I'm not going to read it all, but this is an example of the kinds of investments that we've made as a CCO. This is a snapshot of our work within the Portland metro area of the kinds of initiatives that have come out of our engagement with our clinical partners. So we've got four major focus areas. They're standard and usual care, so how do we make regular primary care work more efficient and more efficacious? How do we manage high-risk populations? How do we maximize access? And that was a key call-out based on the ACA expansion experience. We wanted to make sure there was adequate access for all of our members. And then behavioral health integration. We've also expanded significantly our alternative payment methodologies. Now, this is a percentage, so the total investment in primary care has gone up over time in actual dollars, but the percentage of those dollars going towards more quality and performance-based payments has gone up from 11% back in the beginning of 2014 to now over 30%, which is very exciting. And that is it. So,
just that.
Okay, we're going to collect questions. Round of applause for our presenter. Yeah. Let's taking questions here, so Pastor Dan is going to work the room, that side of the room. I'll take questions. Anybody's got questions? Writing your questions down. So we're going to spend the next half an hour, or about 25 minutes or so, taking questions. And I'll start with this. Sam is going to collect them there. So Oregon started with many people in managed care. Would it be an advantage or disadvantage to ship managed care and go directly to a CCO model? You just take turns.
Well, I would say a CCO model is a type of managed care. It's just a way of organizing, and I would use the word democratizing, how that managed care is implemented. So I do think, I will say our experience in the communities that had a significant penetration of managed care was very different than those communities that did not. Not all of our counties had mandatory managed care prior to the CCO experience. And we had a few counties that had a pretty low penetration. They had an option for managed care, perhaps, but not mandatory. And so you had members who were not accustomed to a managed care environment. You had providers who were not accustomed to a managed care environment. And it took a lot of legwork and engagement on the ground to say, okay, there may be a reason that you didn't have managed care in this community. How do we work together? How do we have shared accountability for how dollars are spent in our community? So we got away from this is a form of, classic, HMO managed care, and more about there is a fixed dollar amount that we've got to manage, literally. So how do we design a system that meets both your need as a provider to make sure your patients are getting the right kind of care at the right time, and you patient having access to the services that you find most important and that you need for your family? So we got it away from, we're not talking about, your big bad HMO. We're really talking about shared management of the resource.
I do think, though, that the previous managed care contractors who are our major partners in the CCOs across the state, they had a lot of competencies already that they were adding these new requirements to. And starting from scratch, it might have been a little bit harder. I also think that the fact that there was a lot of managed care in Oregon, not just from the health plan perspective, but that providers out there were used to contracting with and billing a managed care payer as opposed to just the state's Medicaid agency. And so you didn't have to build the competency of the provider community up to, what's it like to have some of my reimbursement based on performance.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to have your quality measured? And what's it like to get reports from a payer that say, here's the percentage of your panel, here's a list of people on your panel that have diabetes, and here's what our utilization data says how you're doing in terms of getting A1Cs and foot exams and eye exams and so forth for management.
Yeah, and I would say from a staff perspective at the administrative level, one of our highest or fastest growing staff areas is around that network engagement piece, because we can't hit our CCO metrics without our provider community. We also want to keep them engaged and ensure access to all of our members. And for those that had not been accustomed to participating either with a managed care plan or with OHP in general, wanted to be able to work with their frontline staff with a provider directly to make sure that they knew how to access our system and that we were responsive to any issues, questions, challenges that they were having.
You sure don't want to give a delivery system risk if you're not going to provide the analytics and the technical assistance and the information and data to help them manage that risk, right? We saw what happened in the late 80s, early 90s across the whole country with provider groups taking on a lot of risk and not having the tools to manage that risk. And that's the reason why there's hardly any commercial HMOs left, right? And they might be back someday, but that's really key competencies to have in place. And because we did have a managed care system, we didn't have to build that from scratch.
What was the financial investment required upfront to develop the CCO model, and has that model resulted in cost savings? It's a two-part question, or actually a three-part question. How long did it take to see those cost savings, assuming that there were some? And did you have any? Do you have any data about where the greatest cost savings came from in the model?
So upfront capital is a little challenging to answer. The state of Oregon has a statutory minimum risk-based capital that it requires, a reserve level that it requires of each of its CCOs. And because many of the CCOs were operating as a managed care plan under that same statutory model, they just converted their MCO reserves into their CCO reserves. And then as membership grew, they had to accrue additional reserves to capture the any growth in membership that they had. So there wasn't sort of a, you know, we have to write a check or something like that, except for the new CCOs that came about. They had to figure out how to have some sort of capital contribution, either from hospital partners, other providers, or maybe a health plan partner that they had. So I think you can look at what your kind of risk comfort would be for that kind of reserve model. I would say that Oregon's statutory reserve level is pretty low relative to the commercial market. So we at Care Oregon felt like the statutory minimum wasn't enough for us to feel comfortable about our level of reserve. But it's
lower than Medicare Advantage, too.
It is lower than Medicare Advantage. So you might want to, you know, peg it to something that has, you know, something like a commercial market or Medicare or something like that would be a benchmark you could look at for what reserve, startup reserve costs would be. And then, of course, there would be the administrative capital expense. And then I'll let you talk about savings.
So we were talking as we were talking before we came over here to give the presentations, we were talking about this. I'm sure that my leadership back in Oregon would like for me to say it's a little bit too early to tell whether this is a complete success or not, although we have annual transformation summit meetings where the whole state and all those stakeholders that we've been talking about get back together to take a look at, you know, how are we doing. And there's lots of encouraging information there. Generally speaking, we see needy individuals and households getting assessed sooner so that a plan can be built around meeting their needs, as Aaron and Martin have talked about, you know, what that looks like. It involves their social determinants and those other things, too, and all the supports. And we talked a little bit this morning about the fact that pharmacy costs probably go up because as you engage the population and assess them, you diagnose more things, and then you're writing more prescriptions. But we also see that emergency department use is lower when people have a medical home that they have access to for basic services, and that you can avoid acute manifestations of people's unwellness if you are providing prevention, health promotion, and primary care in a culturally appropriate way to those sort of population subsets, whether they be pregnant women or persons for whom English is not their primary language, right, which goes beyond just language, right, because the diverse population we have in Oregon includes people who come from cultures where the hospital is where you go to die. It's not a place where you go to get well. And so meeting those folks where they're at and providing access points in the system that go way beyond just clinics and hospitals and surgery centers.
So I just want to touch on this savings question. So fundamentally, a Medicaid plan has three ways of generating a margin. And it can be a combination, but you're either going to be successful in getting a better rate than the cost to your patient, or you're going to be successful in negotiating price, so you're paying your provider network less than it takes to make money, or you're successful at keeping people healthier than the rate you were given. That is to say, the rate wasn't set wrong, but you did such a good job of keeping them healthy that you made money off their good health. I would say if you look at CCOs, this last year, we made a whole bunch of money. And the commercial experience was not as good. There are folks in the room that could talk about
how difficult the commercial market in Oregon, the individual market, was this last year. Not good. The commercial rates are jumping almost 20% on our exchange, but we have a 3.4% cap in the rate of inflation in Medicaid plans. Medicaid plans, even in the 3.4% cap, are still in good shape, despite what one plan is saying. Where in the commercial market, I think, even with the rate increase, there's a little bit of dubiousness about the individual market. So why is the experience so different? The ACA population that we just took on is 100% of poverty to 138, and the expansion population on the exchange of 138% up look very similar. But in Medicaid, we made money on that population. In the commercial market, they just lost their shorts on that population. It's just a little bit wealthier. Why is that? Well, is it the rates were set incorrectly? Yeah, to some extent, we got paid generously by the federal government for the expansion population, and that's because they didn't have any history with an uninsured population set rates on, so their guess was high. And frankly, I think Obama was trying to get states to take the ACA expansion population, so Oregon was a beneficiary of being in a state where we took the population. So that was part of it. But even in the plus population where the rates were shot low, there was, and in that 3.4%, there was the opportunity for some CCOs to be fined. So it's not just a rate-setting question, and those rates are coming down. Is it a price negotiation? We now, CCOs, the whole model is that the providers are part of the governance structure. They're at the table. They help decide where the money goes in a global budget. So actually, I think in a lot of cases, the rates for providers have been going up even after the 3.4% cap. One of our plans is paying commercial rates to their primary care. The hospital's rate of uninsurance is going way down, so their cost shift is going way down. Hospitals in Oregon are making a lot of money. It's really not a price fight, at least not right now. So the third explanation, to me, bears the most logic, which is we are doing some things to actually bend the cost curve, to actually produce healthier people. The single best way to bring down the cost of healthcare is to have people be sick less often. That's the brilliance of the CCO model, is we get paid more by keeping people healthy. That's our secret sauce. So I don't know that every transformation proposal that we've put on the table in the last 3 years is successful. Certainly some of them are just costing us money and aren't being successful. But on average, the reduced hospitalization stays, the reduced ER visits, the improved health of our population, the integration systems between behavioral health and physical health, all of those things collectively are bearing fruit. We may not actually have the data to prove that for a couple more years, but we've got a business model that proves it. We're making money with the same population that the commercial market's losing money on. That, to me, is the proof.
So, Martin, you started out by saying you came here, you visited South Central Foundation's work, and then you went back to Oregon, and now we brought you back here to be the expert in the state. So just in that context, I'll ask you this question. Some people have said that the Oregon model is too advanced for Alaska to adapt. Do you agree or disagree, and why?
Well, I always think of South Central as very much like your Oregon. There's always that you're never a prophet in your own land. We tell folks in Oregon frequently the things that we think Cure Oregon does that are interesting and different, and sometimes we don't get heard as well as if we move to another state. And I think we came and saw in South Central some things that you all down the street have something to learn from. And it's not a model that's completely can't replicate it exactly, but it has these characteristics which are important. One, there's an enormous emphasis on the member, the patient at the center of the care, culturally specific, really patient-focused care. And I think we have adapted that in Oregon, and that's not some secret model. That's a culture. That's a philosophy. And so we incentivize it in some ways, but a lot of it is just deciding that that's going to be the most important thing. They have some specific techniques around patient-centered primary care that we've brought back that were the beginning of our patient-centered primary care renewal. That was a Cure Oregon term. It's now become a PCPCH model, which is patient-centered primary care home model, which has incentive payments. So we've managed to convert an idea about how to do primary care in a more effective way, first as a company and then as a state with incentive measures. That's certainly a model that can be replicated in your primary care system everywhere. And, I mean, I'm not the clinician. I'm not the technical expert about everything at South Central that went well. I'll tell you that the one other thing that I really took away from that experience, there was consistency in the relationship between the providers of it was everyone's patient. It was the warm handoff. It wasn't integration like integrating money risk. It wasn't the integration of it was a clinical integration where every clinician, regardless of what they did in that system, knew the same patient story and the same patient experience. They shared the patient story. I don't think we've come close to that in Oregon. But I think, to me, that's the thing that's left. Like, when we talk about integration, that's what it really looks like. It looks at the point where the clinicians, they essentially had an integrated health system where the clinicians really knew the member. So I don't know. I mean, when we first went there, frankly, we came back and everyone said it was a unicorn. It's like, it's one of a kind. There's nothing like it. You can't, you know, everybody can be a unicorn. That might actually be true. They might actually have something that's pretty unique. But to the extent that there's an awful lot that you can take from it, you know, we've taken a lot from it.
Anybody else jump in?
Stakeholder buy-in is a deal breaker. I'm tempted to say, if you believe you can do it, then you're ready, you can do it. And if you don't all believe it, then a few folks not wanting to participate is probably enough to stop it from happening, whether that's at your capital or out in your delivery system.
Just follow up on that then. Can you talk a little bit about what that process was to get that buy-in?
Well, you're all familiar with Peter Pan, right? So you get your fairy dust and sprinkle it, and then when people believe, then they can fly. No. It's that opportunity of crisis. I think maybe some of the things we're doing actually were proposed by some folks earlier, and because there was still belief that you could make incremental tweaks to the system and get by for another biennium, they didn't happen. Sharing risk, that's not a new concept. Anybody who's been involved in network development or a health plan work in the last 25 years knows that, you know, giving risk to providers is something you can do, and it works some places, and some places it doesn't work. It was really about, we also had senior government officials with a vision and a lot of energy around this. Have you ever heard our governor at the time talk about this? I mean, I said that the policy work group was formed before he was sworn in. I mean, the election was in November, and in December, our bosses all pulled us together and said, you know, tell your staff they're not going to see you for a while, drop what you're doing, and work on this, because they want the health policy board to have it, you know, by spring, so that we can get to work on implementing it.
Leadership was huge in this. And leadership that saw the value in literally touring the state and listening to stakeholders, figuring out who the leaders were in each community, to have them continue the conversation within their community was really key. As I started off by saying, having real clarity of purpose. We kind of knew what we were solving to. It was just a matter of how do we set it up in a way that everyone can swallow, even those that had to kind of hold their nose and swallow. Not everybody was, you know, fully on board and excited about it. We had a variety of levels of excitement, I would say. But we got to something that everyone felt like their voice was heard. They had the opportunity to be heard and to help shape where things were going.
Yeah. Time for a couple more questions here. So how does the state determine the global budget allocation?
I laugh because we've had a shift very recently in how that's done.
I'm not sure what that question could mean a lot of different things. At a high level, there's an actuarial process. You know, initially, we had a lowest cost estimate template, so we gave all the CCOs a template with all these cost areas, and we asked them to project what their costs would be and submit those, and that was the basis for the development of rates. And sort of implicit in there was, and by the way, if it's too high, then you don't get a contract, right? So everybody was really aggressive. And everybody thought about what their major innovations were going to be and projected what savings they might be able to get out of that. But there was a lot of guesswork involved. And then once that first couple of contracts were out of the way, then you had that, you saw from the slides, the sustainable growth rate, or the capped inflation at 3.4% per year. And while that sounds pretty low, if you've been running a system that's, you know, that's been inflating at higher than that, it is predictable. You know what you're going to have each year. And you know that if you're making investments in some areas, you got some data that shows you're going to get a return on those investments in other areas. You can factor some of that in. So at this point now, it's an actuarial exercise. It's using NAIC principles, and it's reviewed by actuaries back at CMS before those rates are approved. We're literally in the part of the year right now in October. Where our actuaries are finalizing those rates, and that's all back in D.C. being looked at by theirs to see if they buy it.
And I do think this is an area that's going to have some evolution in the next few years because we haven't gotten it buttoned down. And I think the state's vision of what a global budget would be was a little more fixed over time than what it's turned out to be. And CMS has come in, and they want to see under the hood and have a say in how those rates are developed. And I think there's been a little bit of a philosophical clash between those that see a global budget as really kind of a block grant almost that grows at a sustainable rate and those that have much more of an actuarial bent that want to be able to predict future rates based on historical performance and utilization. And those things are not entirely incompatible, but they're also not entirely compatible, and that's kind of where the active conversation is happening right now. And I know it's even part of the new waiver renewal that is going to be taking place over the next 18 months or so, is getting a more consistent message about how the global budget will be determined.
Minimum medical loss ratios in the conversation. Now, I mean, it was this past year just for the ACA population. But, you know, if it's more like a block grant, then if there's lots of money left over at the end of the year, you could just reinvest that. Whereas if there's a minimum MLR target and you have a lot of surplus, then you've got to give it back. And what would you rather see? You know, I don't know. Nobody wants to see Medicaid managed care plans make double-digit profits, but if that's all being reinvested into the system to improve care and continue driving the total cost of care down, that would be a good thing.
Right.
Do you have any legislators in the room? One? Just for you guys, so the answer, if I was lobbying you, because that's my first profession before I became an insurance executive, as a lobbyist, so now not exactly a distinguished career, but
you won't say that with your baby boy in the room.
What I said to legislators is we've signed a 10-year agreement with the federal government that will limit our Medicaid increase to 3.4% a year, and we're, what, 3-4 years into that?
Mm-hmm.
3 years into that. So that's the simple answer. What these guys just explained was the complicated way that the rates are set for each individual plan, which might be a little bit more, a little bit less than 3.4%. But if you're managing a budget, the answer is, arguably, the federal government says Medicaid goes up by 3.4%. That's 2% less than trend. Over 10 years, that's saving the federal government a lot of money. In exchange, they gave us $1.9 billion to dig us out of a financial hole. I don't know if you're in a financial hole, but if you were, just saying, this might be a good time to make a deal.
Have you read our papers? Well, to that end, then, can you tell, last question, and before we take a break here, so what was the upfront financial investment of the legislature into going into this model? Anybody know?
They cut our rates 10%.
They cut your rates 10%?
Yeah. Yeah, so it was, yeah, so literally this was the worst bottom of the trough of the recession with 2008, 9, 10, was it?
Mm-hmm.
So it was 2009. And they said, we're going to have to cut your rates. Actually, originally it was more than 10%. We argued them up to 10%. But this, don't worry about it, though. We're going to integrate mental health, oral health, physical health, all these things into one pot. So the pot's going to be bigger. You're all going to have more money, but you're also going to have a whole lot more things that cost a whole lot more money. Figure it out. And there have been, I mean, in all fairness, there have been transformation funds along the way that were raised from surplus dollars and the hospital tax that came as part of the federal ACA. But, no, literally the session where we all had to sort of see this happen, there was a 10% budget cut. That's what we got.
And for 07, 09, and 09, 011 biennia, every subsequent revenue forecast was worse than the last
mm-hmm.
one. It just kept getting worse and worse and worse.
That sounds familiar. Anyone?
And the federal investment that we got really just filled that the budget deficit. It wasn't extra money that the feds poured in to help us with the CCO model. It just kept us from having to cut further.
Well, we have more questions, so we'll come back and ask more questions. We are going to take a 15-minute break until 3:15. When we reconvene, we're going to come to the tables and ask you to talk to each other for a few minutes. Everybody ready to get started again? The mics are trying to work here. Martin had to run and take a call, but we'll welcome him back as soon as he can. With time, just for a couple more questions that I have with me for our guests, and then we're going to have some conversation at our tables. I'll wait for, we've lost your other guy. Look, we can just ask you questions.
I know. Queen for a day.
Sure. Lost your partners in crime. You want to try? You want to take a stab at it? We can always invite others here. Where in the CCM is there an affirmative motivation for any of the beneficiary cohort to evolve to self-sufficiency and out of the CCM population?
I think that's a great question. One we haven't really tackled entirely, but the hope would be that by engaging, upskilling our providers to have a much more kind of culturally competent engagement with their patients, by having our community advisory councils as a forum for members to get together to talk about what they need, what makes sense to them, what doesn't make sense to them. A lot of the system that we designed historically made sense from a business model or from a perspective that made sense to accountants or actuaries or others like that. And we found where we invite members in to help us design educational materials, programs, other things that really are understandable, accessible. So, you know, one piece of the triple aim is around satisfaction. And so we've really put some time and energy on developing member satisfaction looks like and how to meet people where they are. And it's a lot easier said than done, because it isn't a, if you do this, then everyone will, you know, be compliant, or if you do this, then members will really be engaged in being drivers of their own health. But what we have found is that when you have a table like a community advisory council, you can have at least a impact on a subset of your population to be to help you to design a system that will enable people to be accountable for their own health decisions and have a better understanding of where they have power to make decisions. I think a lot of our population, we hear, feel very disempowered based on their life experience or, you know, just whatever circumstances they may be in their life. And if we can figure out how to empower them to at least be a driver in their own health, that's an opportunity that's there. But it isn't explicitly drawn out, because I don't think anybody is expert at it yet. Sort of, we know how to talk about it a little bit. We know how to create tables to have conversations about it, but I don't think anybody has really executed on it 100% effectively.
I'll ask the question just for your benefit. You see if you want to weigh in or not. No pressure to do that, though. Where in the CCM model is there an affirmative motivation for any of the beneficiary cohort to evolve to self-sufficiency and out of the CCM population?
I could probably provide more information about that if I take it back and talk to some of my colleagues in Oregon and send that answer to you for you to distribute. But I do think that an emphasis on prevention and wellness and health promotion and a way bigger investment that we're making, even out of this last legislative session. A lot of people asked for more money from our legislators and didn't get it, but the increased investment in behavioral health programs still happened. So I think that there's a realization occurring that if people aren't in stable living situations and emotionally well, expecting them to go to a job every day and pay taxes and that kind of thing is probably a stretch. So if you get people's chronic conditions under control, you're addressing persistent mental illness and addiction, and you're also the emphasis on addiction treatment includes peer peer specialists delivered services, which the evidence is growing, showing that that's really effective. So I talked to some people at vocational rehab, which is not part of the health authority per se. It's not part of the Medicaid program, and it hasn't been part of most of this transformation. But I said, you know, if a well person really is a self-actualized person, once you've got these crises managed and people have stable housing and they're not food insecure and their addiction and emotional and mental health issues are addressed and they're providing self-care and self-management of, say, diabetes or hypertension or what have you, now what? Do people really need something to get up every morning and go do in order to really feel well? And my personal belief is that for the human organism, that is the case, and that the reason more people aren't self-sufficient is because they're dealing with this other stuff. So, but I don't have the science for you on that.
Thanks. So we'll take one last question, and then we'll go to tables, and then we'll see where we are with time. So did you consider adding state employees and retirees to the system?
The Governor Kitzhaber's original vision or early vision was to have public employees. We have our public employees split between sort of general public employees and Oregon educators through K-12 education, but to have both of those systems run through the CCOs. And he was not successful in integrating those. I think that it was partly a political challenge and partly that there was some change fatigue at the level of the CCOs that we weren't quite ready to expand quite at the rate that we would have needed to include public employees at the time that was being discussed. But instead, in lieu of integrating public employees into the CCO model, what the state of Oregon chose to do is issue an RFP for the plans that wanted to participate and offer insurance coverage to public employees to have a CCM model and demonstrate that in their applications to offer public employees insurance coverage. So they have to demonstrate many of the same components that CCOs do in order to get the contract with the state.
The only thing I would add to that is really tiny, and that just is that I think this next year is going to be a big year for really a lot of data, a lot of reporting and data released publicly that says this is exactly what this did to the cost and the wellness of these populations. And I think you might have some employers asking, wow, I'd like to do that to my healthcare costs. Is there a commercial CCO out there somewhere that I can get a proposal from? And when they ask for that, the plans will deliver it. You know, every other time the market said we want this, the insurance market has responded. And the market's going to ask for this if this really drives quality and lower costs, isn't it?
Excellent. Thanks. Okay, so we're going to spend the next about 20 minutes or so just at your tables. I just want to hear what you're thinking about with each other. So there are, if you would assign somebody to be your scribe, because we do want to collect your thinking here, and we'll invite you to use the yellow sticky note pads on the table. We really have three questions for you, and you can take them at your table in any order. They're not overly complicated, so I'll just read all three of them to you at the same time. So which part of this model, this Oregon model, do you feel actually translates here to Alaska? Which part do you feel like translates? Which part are you absolutely sure at this moment in time won't work here? So essentially, which part are you feeling great about? Which part are you sure is never going to work? And what new questions does that prompt for you? So what we're hoping for from this, from that piece of sticky note is a bunch more questions from you. And we do have commitment from our presenters, as we did in Colorado, to take these questions and come back in some sort of other format to get your questions answered. So your questions aren't going in vain. We may not have time to deal with them here at the tables or answer them all today, but we will get them answered. So one is, what are you sure? Which parts do you think might work? The next question is, what are you sure is never going to work? And the third one is, what more questions does that prompt for you? Let me tell you what report out's going to look like, just so you're prepared for that. We're going to ask one person at the table to be your spokesperson, and what we're going to ask them to report about is that one question, so we can hear, and we'll ask our facilitators to, or our presenters to answer that single question. We're going to collect them all, but we're going to answer one from each table. So I'll give you about 20 minutes. About 20 minutes or so. I think we'll be on track. So about quarter till and ish, I'll call you back. you want to start getting to the place where you're narrowing down to the question that you want to ask the panelists. So make sure you're focusing in now on that last question as we wind up our time. Give you one final minute just to wrap things up. All right, everybody. We have some scribes. We have some reporters. We're going to go around the room. We do want to collect what you wrote, so make sure that we get that. Okay, everybody. So the way we're going to do report out, I wish we had time to report on everything you talked about, but we don't. So we're going to collect what you scribed out about the things that you think will work and the things that you think are just absolute deal breakers, they're not going to work. But how we're going to use this time, because we can collect all those and we'll create some pro-con lists for sure. But how we're going to use this last 45 minutes of our time is to find that one key question that you talked about in your table. So we'll ask the reporter from each of the tables to ask the question. Our panelists have agreed to answer that one key question, and we're going to work our way around the room. So I'm actually going to start over here at our small table of two here. And I'll, who's our voice here?
We thought the 2703 would work in Alaska. I'd read your state plan amendment, and it was pretty. Your 2703 approach seemed very broad, like seemed to include a lot of providers. So at some point, I'm going to ask you about that. Yes, some of the other 2703s that other states have done were much more specific. They were smaller provider groups. Your 2703 state plan seems really expansive, a lot of people involved in it. How did you manage it? Is it saving money? And, is it saving money?
Okay, well, first answer what a 2703 is. I love these rooms, right?
Section 2703. I'm working from memory here, right? I don't have it in front of me. And also, we submitted that state plan for an effective date in October of 2011, and so that two-year federal enhanced match ended in 2013. So while our patient-centered primary care home initiative is not done, the enhanced federal match that we made payments to those clinics on was only for that period from between October 2011 to 2013, and then it was done, and that all went back to the regular match rate. Oregon was one of the states that decided not to continue those supplemental or enhanced payments after the federal investment ended because our legislature didn't fund it. So, but what it did was it paid, depending on what level you were certified at, tier one, two, or three, it paid between six and $9 PMPM to those clinics for the Medicaid eligibles that were attributed to those clinics as the medical home, on top of the state's fee schedule for fee for service, our BRVS reimbursement. And what that did was that funded the change in their model of care to more of a team-based approach. And then subsequent to that, when it became apparent that was going to be a big part of the CCO delivery system, then the number of clinics applying for that certification, adopting EHRs. Remember, there are federal Medicaid and Medicare EHR incentive monies available to clinics that adopt a product that meets the standard. It changed the delivery model for those clinics. And as I said, we had more than 400 of them that ended up applying and getting certified across the state. And the CCOs have more than 50 or 60% of their members impaneled with a medical home that's a certified patient-centered medical home. So I think for us in Oregon, the federal intent for that did what it was supposed to do. It was the additional money that provided the incentive for clinics to change their model of delivering primary care. And once they had changed that, and by the way, clinics might have done it for a Medicaid incentive payment, but it's way easier to change the way your clinic operates for everyone who walks through the door than it is to just do it for Medicaid and to keep delivering care the old way to commercial and Medicare enrollees. So I think what's happened at most of those clinics is they just have a new business model now. They staff it differently. They deliver it differently. They schedule differently. And now that's business as usual for them. So we got a lot of questions at the end of 2013. Is Oregon going to continue to fund that after the federal investment stops? And so I know there was interest out there, but we had to say, no, we're not funding it. And it didn't result in anybody going back to their old model of care that I know of.
Great, thank you. I'm going to come back. I'm going to excuse myself here. Who's our spokesperson here? All right.
So one of the things we talked about that was echoed a lot in the panel was that you really had the strong political leadership and leadership in your organizations to make this happen. So what came up for us was a question for all of us in the room that is, do we have that leadership, you know, in the industry, but particularly in the legislature to make this happen? And then our question for you is, what can we do to incentivize our leadership to make this a priority? And if you had any advice for us, what you would, that would be.
Well, so a couple observations. There is nothing that really replaces strong commitment and leadership, and it was certainly policymakers, but more of that resided in rooms like this. The stakeholders in Oregon are a remarkable group of folks, hospitals. They compete every day, sit at tables like this, and work together to figure out how to solve problems. Same with the commercial insurers and the Medicaid plans and the primary care plans. So we're a strange frenemies kind of state. Having said that, I don't know that you can do a lot. You can't maybe do the kind of massive change everything overnight healthcare reform that Oregon did without having some critical mass. But you can do a lot off of a few really strong leaders if collectively you say to those folks, we're comfortable with you taking the next steps. We're comfortable with you leading. And so maybe if you're at a place where you're just getting started, it's a question of finding a few people in the room who everyone else is comfortable saying, you have some leash. Go help us figure out what the next few steps are. And any journey starts with those next few steps. And in some ways, there's an advantage to not having people tripping all over each other. The flip side in Oregon is when we ran into problems, it was because we had too many leaders, too many folks who all had strong opinions, and it took a long time to sort of smooth the path because we weren't going to do everybody's best idea. We're going to do somebody's best idea. So you might be able to accomplish the same thing with like 1,000 less meetings than we had. And that's not necessarily terrible either. One last observation, which is, you know, Oregon is a little bit of a one-party state right now. So a lot of it was if you had Democratic leadership, you were going to get there. And we had a lot of Republican leaders in this process too. But, you know, that's just a political reality is we were working on the left side of the dial. You guys are probably not going to have the left side of the dial. I don't know how bipartisan you are. Maybe it's just one side of the dial. It's the right side of the dial. It could be. I think most of this stuff is actually fundamentally more conservative. The idea of a smart purchasing system where you're spending the dollars that you're getting in a responsible way and not diverting it into, you know, not breaking up your leverage into lots of small plans, not creating expectations, not creating measurable results. I mean, you wouldn't run a business the way most states run their healthcare system. You just wouldn't. So most of what you're talking about in the blueprint that we handed out is just a good business practice and not a hard sell to conservatives at all. So I make this point in Oregon all the time. We did not do the ACA. We came first, and we have an Oregon model, and it's different than the ACA. In some ways, it's a lot better than the ACA, and it focuses on Medicaid, not on the exchange. Our exchange has been a little bit of a problem, and that's really not the ACA's fault. That was more of a technology problem. But if you want to know what healthcare reform in Oregon looks like that's successful, it really is in the Medicaid market. That came first. So I don't, in our experience, I don't think you have to rely on the federal government to be your lead. They're going to be your pocketbook at some point. They're going to fund a lot of it, but they don't have to be your lead. Your lead can be a homegrown innovation, and it doesn't have to sound like Obamacare. It can sound pretty right to the right and still be a successful strategy.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, tacking on to what Martin says, it's not – the ACA was about getting everyone covered. Our transformation is about delivering outcomes and costing less. And I agree, that shouldn't be a hard sell to conservatives. The other thing is I think if you have champions from different sectors, right, you're not going to have every legislator on board with this. So if you've got some, that's good. People who aren't on board with it are going to say, well, the delivery system will never go for it. That's when you need a hospital somewhere and a physician group to stand up and say, well, we want to do this.
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't need everybody on board, but you need champions in the different sectors of the stakeholder population.
Excellent, thank you. I'm going to come up to this table here. Who's our voice here? Okay, we discussed the fact that we do not have any Medicaid managed care organizations in Alaska, and our private insurance market isn't very robust. So we were wondering if, understanding that most of the CCOs in Oregon are former managed care organizations, and there are maybe a couple that were insurers. If you think that would be a problem in Alaska, we have a private insurance market with really one dominant health insurer and maybe a couple of others. We've had a few insurance companies just pull out this year. We only have two insurance companies on our federally facilitated marketplace.
So my observation, just three real quick ones. One is we have counties that took on this responsibility, and they have insurers as their – so we are the insurer that backs up Yamhill County, and Yamhill County really put the CCO together. So there are models in Oregon of CCOs that are not, you know, governanced and created by plans. We also have a couple of hospital-owned and run CCOs, which is another direction to go. And then I just point out that to your immediate right, you have somebody that knows a lot about this. And I'm not exactly sure why Robin's in the room, but I'm guessing you might be able to borrow from another state their entire plan.
Yeah, I think you need some risk management skills at the table, but that's just one component, and you can buy that.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, I'll come back here. Who's our voice? Don't all speak at once.
So we had a great verbal discussion, not a whole lot of writing going on, so forgive us for that. But we talked a lot about, you know, certainly whether or not this model works in Alaska, but also this top slide here, the challenge plus urgency equals opportunity piece, and how that really seems to apply to what's going on in Alaska with our current fiscal situation here. And I'm not going to remember every single thing we said, so I hope the three of you can please forgive me. Yeah. So would Alaska have the population scale to accomplish a move like Oregon? And what I mean by that is we all know where the populated areas are, but in the really rural areas, and rural in Alaska is different from rural in Oregon by a pretty large degree. You know, could something like this work in extreme rural Alaska?
We don't know.
Can you speak a little to scale?
I mean, honestly, the person from Oregon who's closest to the expert is Robin or Sean, because MOTA has got the rural plan. You guys are just, when you say rural, you're just way more rural, probably even than you know, MOTA is. Plan out in eastern Oregon. So I think we have a lot of rural enterprises, but when we say rural, we're talking about places like Anchorage. I mean, not quite, but we're talking about communities of thousands of people. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. And the challenges mostly are about getting the right kind of provider and provider access, and then, you know, information technology that we're all learning to depend on sometimes doesn't exist there. So there is an awful lot more, from a plan's perspective, we have to fill in a lot of gaps as a plan. And Aaron can probably talk to more about that. But we basically go, I think for the rural communities that Care Oregon is in, we were always there. We were not a very active partner for our provider network. And what CCOs have required us to do is become much more active in helping them identify workforce opportunities, technology opportunities. What does it really mean to move a metric, and how do we, you know, create some – bring some technologies, some healthcare technologies that are really common in the Portland area that they may just not have seen. And some of that is even just patient management and care management. And then after all that, still recognize that it's still sometimes it's not going to be as effective because they've got less resources to work with. So, I mean, if there is a parallel, it's find some pocketbook that's deep enough that insurer can go out to rural communities and prop folks up, because that's mostly what Care Oregon ends up doing in these rural communities is going out and using our resources to prop up communities that don't have the resources on their own. And I bet that's MOTA's experience as well. Robin, do you have anything you want to add? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you really do know this better than we do.
It can be done. I mean, I was sharing at the table, we have counties with maybe one provider. There's no tertiary hospitals in our entire geography. We've had to go out and, you know, build those relationships. Care goes to Idaho. Care goes to Washington. Out of our, it can be done. It's hard work, as you said earlier. It's a lot of work, and there are a lot of gaps. And we didn't fit some of the models that the urban folks did, but I think the community governance part of this really directed a lot of what we did. We did not do this as MOTA. In fact, if we didn't have those partnerships with the providers and with the counties, and with the population, we weren't going to do it because it wasn't going to work. And the one thing I will do, I've said this before, the one thing that the state did is they built the box for us. They told us what we were going to do. We were going to get a global budget. We were going to have primary care medical homes. So there was only one primary care medical home in that entire 12-county thing. Now, over 70% of our patients are served by primary care medical homes for the reasons you talked about. Mm-hmm. And we only had one at the start. But you gave us the box and what to do it in, and then gave us the flexibility to do it. We didn't know how we were going to do it. We did it by conversations with leaders, like you talked about, with hospitals, with primary care providers. We did it with county governments, and we did it with all the rest of the stakeholders, or it wouldn't have happened. This doesn't come from some higher level down to do it. It comes more from the ground up.
So there won't be one thing you'll do in your really, really remote rural communities to solve that problem. There'll probably be a little benefit that comes from doing a lot of different things. It's going to involve transportation. It's going to involve getting creative with the workforce so that expanded practice, dental hygienists, and maybe community paramedics can deliver basic services in those areas. Or you might have medical groups that hit the road and go around to these places, telehealth, all that stuff.
One of the questions in the stack of questions was about the use of telehealth in your model. Do you want to spend 6 seconds on that?
Sure. we're building out some capacity in some of our more rural communities using New Mexico's ECHO model is one that we're using that helps expand what can happen in a primary care setting. And also it helps to expand some, we're working on expanding some specialty access in places where specialists are a long ways away. That's the 6 second bite.
Yeah, that was good. Nice job. Okay, who's our spokesperson here?
How does one go about developing the capacity to manage risk, so the financial and the analytical, et cetera, et cetera?
It is a skill set that exists within any insurance model, which is why I said to this table it's something that you can go and buy. And in terms of building it, I would say go and talk to people who do it for a living. That's the best that I can offer. I'm sure that there are degree programs in universities that talk about how insurance functions from an academic perspective, but I think only when you're doing it and know what kinds of analytic tools that you need and which lenses you really need to pay attention to notice when something is an outlier or the beginnings of a trend that really require attention is the only way that you're going to build that capacity. Pretty complex world that requires some really mathematical thinkers that I have on my staff that I fortunately for everyone don't have to do myself. I sort of get the 80,000 foot view, but I've got analysts on my team that really delve into the data and help us to do identify opportunities for intervention based on risk management models.
Anybody else want to jump in?
It's in the data.
It's in the data, okay.
So you need data experts, mm-hmm. Utilization. And.
Did you create, when we heard from Colorado folks, they talked about creating a whole new way to capture all their data. Did you have to do that in Oregon as well?
We're doing it. I wouldn't say we figured it out by any stretch, but it takes a huge amount of time and energy on my team now to develop the data and analytic capability to do it well.
That's probably a good time to add, too. That was a big, big thing for CMS.
Mm-hmm.
In the negotiation of that waiver and the investment they made, they wanted way more complete and accurate and timely data. And most of what we've done was to comply with the STCs of that waiver, getting it way sooner. You can't, if there's money flying out the window, you can't wait 6 months after the data service to find out that you've got a problem. Because your quarter of your biennium's gone, then you're already in the hole.
And is the data living at the state, or is it living in the CC? Are you sharing one system, or how is that working?
We submit some data to the state, but it's there's a lag between what the state has and what we submit. So the more real-time data is at the CCO level, and then is sort of aggregated and submitted to the state.
All right, I'm coming to the table of two here.
Table of two with two questions. The first question we have is whether or not substance abuse and behavioral health services were able to be expanded through this role, this model, and if so, in what way? Was it added value services or something like that that the CCOs provided? And then the other one real quick is whether or not the tribal health systems involved in this are all or they're standalone, just like I think I would expect they are, like the commercial market.
So I'll start with the substance abuse and behavioral health services. And yes, they have been expanded in many ways. We're not totally there yet. I think that's an area, the area of integration and expansion is something that's going to take our attention for the next several years. But I can give you some concrete examples. One is we've just invested over $1 million on developing behavioral health services in the primary care setting, going beyond just co-location, but actually integrated behaviorists with the primary care setting that have access to the same EMR, that are communicating and managing patients with warm handoffs. And in addition, we're also helping to develop a behavioral health patient-centered home, so using the same kinds of values and criteria principles of the patient-centered primary care home that's focused on primary care and setting it up in a behavioral health home. Because for many of our members, especially those with severe and persistent mental illness or other kinds of behavioral health issues, they get most of their care in the behavioral health setting as opposed to a physical health primary care setting. So we're from the primary care perspective, reverse co-locating nurse practitioners and other physical health types of practitioners in a behavioral health setting so that people have their diabetes managed or, other kinds of chronic physical health conditions in the behavioral health setting. And then we're also evolving some, we've built, for example, a non-opioid prescribing pain clinic where providers can refer patients to. We now have two up and running. There's a third one that's in the pipeline to help get patients tapered off of any opioids that they're on and develop some skills around pain management that don't involve opioid prescriptions. And that is all stuff that's grown out of our clinical work groups, or the tables of clinicians saying, this is my pain point, this is what I really need help from the CCO to develop in my that kind of capacity in my community.
Do you want to?
And we don't do the tribal's out.
Yeah. You don't include the tribal health system in your.
So here's what we do. Respecting the sovereignty of the tribes meant that they weren't required to do the CCO thing. However, tribal IHS 638 and other tribal programs, urban Indian programs, they've got all the same objectives we do, right? They want coordinated and integrated care. They want good outcomes, and they want it to cost less. So they're involved, and we do have at the Medicaid agency, one of my staff is a tribal health programs contracting liaison that's traveling around the state and working with the tribal clinics and the CCOs to get rid of the barriers that exist to a tribal clinic being in the network of the health plan. And there are some credentialing problems with that. There are some problems with the fact that those clinics are available to tribals, but other people couldn't choose them. One solution, we've seen solutions work a lot of different ways, like not contracting with the tribal clinic, but paying them for primary care and accepting their referrals to local specialty. The problem we're experiencing with Oregon mostly with the fact that a lot of AIAN population are not enrolled in managed care is they're getting great integrated primary care and behavioral health and addiction treatment at the tribal clinic, but when they're referred into the community to see surgeons, imaging centers, labs, and hospitals, they're getting turned away because it's fee-for-service, and the rate's not as good as what the plan pays, and so that's a problem. And yet if they join the CCO, now they've got access to the specialty network, but their tribal clinic might not be able to be their PCP. So we still have to crack that nut.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. I'm coming here. Who's our?
I'm going to build on some of the questions some of the other folks have asked, and I actually have a compounded question. We talked a bit about the fact that we're rural. We don't have managed care in Alaska. That is a challenge. So some of the questions build on that observation, and the main question is, how do we tailor a CCO model in Alaska? What flexibility do we have? How can those work in rural communities? We have a very unique rural setting in Alaska. And how many CCOs should we have? Should we break it out geographically, look at willingness to participate, or cultural communities?
So in 2 minutes or 1 minute or less, could you just tell us how to do it? That would be great. So try a big broad brush on that.
Yeah. Well, I think the slide that I had that said the key components where you've got to figure out what your geographic scope, and you've got to do something that makes sense. You know, if people in Anchorage aren't, you know, aligned with the people in Fairbanks region, then it doesn't make sense to put them in the same CCO. But if you've got, you know, communities that share catchment areas or some sort of referral pattern or have some sort of cultural alignment or whatever, you know, you can figure out kind of what makes sense for each of those communities and say, okay, we're going to draw a string around this geographic region and you're in it together, and now you guys have got to figure out how you're going to manage the services for all the communities in your service area. But in Oregon, it wasn't even self-evident at the start of the CCOs what all of those regions were going to look like. I mean, Martin talked about speed dating. That's really what it looked like. And we all, do you want to be a CCO? Do you want to be a CCO? Do you know? We had a lot of these kinds of conversations to figure out what shook out and what made sense. So, I mean, that's not one we can figure out. But, Martin, you talk about the CCM quite a bit.
So the CCO model, and it's, again, the diagram, those are elements or traits that you could bring in piece by piece. And in some of this is, it is a question about policymakers and your healthcare stakeholders. So the decision about how many you have and what they look like and whether it's going to manage care, ultimately decisions that if you're going to go down this journey, you're going to make together with your policymakers in rooms like this, and it's not something that Oregon's going to be able to blueprint out for you. But Oregon and Colorado and the states are happy to sort of show you what we've done, but ultimately you'll look different, and you should look different if I don't think that Alaska and Oregon are close enough the same that you could take our blueprint and drop it in Alaska and it would make sense. I do want to point out that you have one advantage here in an area that I think is our biggest deficit. So we're really fond of going to other states and telling people about our community advisory council and how in the statute every CCO has to have a community board that's made up of 51% members that advises the CCO and has one representative, usually out of 15 or 20 board members, there's one representative from that community board. And that's our demonstration of how connected to the community we are. That's fine. That's huge progress. But it's not exactly like you have a school board running the school and the equivalent running your healthcare system. It's pretty different. It's still mostly a provider-run system. This is what we didn't do very well. On all those charts that talk about the percentage of health that's in different sectors, the healthcare sector is 10% of your health. The biggest, by far, are things that have to do with lifestyle choices. And everybody in this room knows this. Most health is taking place in your home, in what you're eating, in how often you're exercising, and who you're associating with, and whether or not your friends are regular avid hikers and outdoors people, or whether your friends are all watching football all Sunday drinking beers with you. Like, most of your health is right there. I actually think that you might have that advantage. It's not managed care exactly, but you have a lot more people who are sort of used to managing their own care. They're very independent. They're living in lots of rural areas. They're not expecting a doctor to solve their problem. They're not expecting a drug company to solve their problem. They're already kind of resilient, in at least they've come to mental terms. If I'm going to live way the bejesus away from everybody else, I've got more responsibility for my health than somebody else does. That's something to work from as a huge positive. The biggest savings in healthcare have nothing to do with plans. They have to do with people accepting responsibility for their own health. And all of us have to stop delegating our health to an insurance company or a doctor. We all have that problem. We always want somebody else to check under the hood for us. We all have to be the mechanics of our own bodies. You've got that advantage. So that's not a managed care advantage, but it's definitely from a DNA. We didn't get that. We are still mostly trying to take care of people rather than really teaching people to take care of themselves.
Thank you.
Okay. Where were you for the
question? Okay, we have two more tables, so hang with us here.
You mentioned the importance of leadership and the critical mass in followers. How can we bring the plan back to local communities and start working them toward the idea of what we're talking about here today.
Well, so, okay, another observation. CARE Oregon spent a lot of time and energy in lobbying trying to get legislators to create something that ultimately became a CCO model. And to be honest, it was kind of a cop-out. We could have done that ourselves. We didn't need the legislature to tell us to do it. If we wanted to integrate mental health and physical health and get all providers in an arrangement where they were at the table and taking shared risk, it would have been a lot of work. But all of those were things we could have done. We didn't need a bill or a law to tell us to do it. What I would say to folks to answer your question is, if you think that there's some value in this model and you're in a community that's, you know, got a set of providers that you can bring to a table, just start building it. And if you start building it and it works, then policy will follow. But we have a tendency, all of us have a tendency, I say all the blue states, it's even a worse tendency to say, oh, now that we've got a good idea, let's run to government and have them do it. I don't know. I mean, I'm a relatively progressive guy, but I can tell you that's not always the best way to solve a problem. If you've got communities willing to take shared risk and hold each other accountable to measures and manage the money as a group rather than individually, then just go do it.
Want to jump in, either of you?
No.
Okay. All right.
You're here.
I'm
all
the
right.
government. He just said don't go to the government.
Don't talk to Don.
That was a test. That was a
He's
test.
He's right. I can't solve all your problems.
That was a test. Excellent. Okay. Last table here.
So we talked quite a bit about long-term care, and I know you said that long-term care has not been part of your model. So we have kind of a two-part question. What other populations were excluded from the Oregon CCO model? And if we were going to do this in Alaska, do you think it'd be feasible to include long-term care services and supports and other excluded populations from the beginning?
Yeah, so the Alaska Native American Indians were the only population specifically called out, although those who are dually eligible can opt out of the CCO model, and there's a small exemption for women in their third trimester who can demonstrate some sort of continuity of care challenge. So it's a pretty small subset of individuals who can opt out. In terms of programs, long-term care is the largest of those that's excluded, and mental health residential services are coming to the CCOs. There's a small pilot with three CCOs integrating that service, but it's the only service that I'm aware of that's specifically excluded still. And yes, you could definitely include it, and there's a lot of conversation internally with the state and at CARE Oregon about how we would – ought to interface with long-term care, because we know a lot of our members are in long-term care settings. There's a lot of opportunity. We do some on the periphery coordination with long-term care settings and staff, but we could do it a lot better. And if we could also align incentives and performance and outcomes across, we could get a lot further than we've gotten with them being carved out. It was a political question.
A lot of things are carved in over time.
Yeah.
On day one, they just had physical health and mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then over the subsequent 3 years, we moved dental in. We moved residential SUD in. You know. And so what's left is just targeted case management, mental health residential, and because we've got a statutory prohibition on long-term care, we'd need a statute change in order to do that one. They are in, yeah.
Although I think that there's some concern by the largest hospital system. Oregon Health Sciences University, OHSU, is our largest hospital and research institution. I think they would tell you they have a disproportionate percentage of the medically needy, and that the CCOs are probably not doing a good enough job in terms of coordinating their care. It's a really specific and complicated population. I just add these things. If we could do it over again and include long-term care, that would be better. But I do make a distinction in long-term care Medicaid between in residential nursing home services, which I don't think necessarily need to be in, and all of those long-term care that are really assistance of daily living and about people staying in their homes. That we should be connected to, because we have people who are in these homes all the time who we have the opportunity to get great data and information from and don't. And a workforce that we have the ability to develop into a workforce that can do some basic assessment or maybe even some basic assistance of a medical nature, then we're not developing that workforce. So that's a big missed opportunity. And the other thing that I think is a little bit of a missed opportunity is we didn't really figure out how to handle the dual eligible population of Medicare, Medicaid, but bringing duals into the model makes a lot of sense. as duals. So they're in for Medicaid purposes, but we haven't figured out how to work with the federal government to integrate the Medicare and the Medicaid and Medicare payments together. So.
Excellent. Thank you all so much. Another round of applause for our excellent. So I'm going to hand this to Sandra here to do some next steps. I do just want to say to you, please, if you took notes at your table, we do want those. Please don't walk away with them. And I'll ask Sandra to close us out.
All right. So one more round of applause for our excellent speakers from Oregon. So who knows the date of our next session? It's on the table. November 16th. We're not quite sure of the time yet, whether we'll do it at lunchtime like we did last month or if we'll do the 1 o'clock. Kind of depends on the legislature and whether or not we get bumped from this room. So that's why we did a later time for this one. So next month we're going to have folks from Washington State come up, and they're going to talk about their innovative managed care structure. And they've also done a recent 1115 waiver that they'll be able to speak to. So with that being said, I'm hoping that you guys are getting value out of coming here. I'm, again, very pleased with the turnout and that you guys stay. You know, it's like, that's amazing to me. So we did a survey last time after the session, and what we had said is that in order for you to get an electronic version of the presentation, that you had to complete the survey, you guys didn't do very well. You know, your compliance was like 13%, which is pretty typical for a survey. But if we decide to do the survey again, it would be valuable for you to, it would be valuable for us, for you to complete that survey so we've got the information. And I'm not sure what incentive I should do to get you to do that survey. Let's see. Okay. So Becky says that she's going to give a prize to the, to the 13th person that fills out that survey. How's that? So anyway, with that being said, go forth, and we will see all of you hopefully next month on November 16th. So thank you.
What other states are they talking to?
I don't know.